This is HPR episode 1702 entitled Fostum 2015 part 5 of 5 and is part of the series interviews. It is hosted by Ken Fallon and is about 62 minutes long. The summary is Reactos, Corios, Wolfsl, Picodp, Ultimaker, Corboot and Flashroam, Satnugs.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi everybody, this is Ken Fallon, we're at the AW building and we're now talking to the guys at ReactOS. And you are?
I'm Alexei Vragin from ReactOS project, I'm coordinator of this project.
Okay, so just to tell the folks at home what ReactOS is and what you're trying to do.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting project, I'm involved in it for about 10 years and this project is about creating an operating system. However, we are not basing it on Linux or on BSD. We do our own kernel from scratch. And the key point is that we are binary compatible with existing Windows applications and existing Windows drivers. This is the key point of the whole project.
So you're building a clone of Microsoft Windows, I guess.
Yes, kind of this. It's not totally correct to call it this way. However, majority of people call it this way. And we also do this.
How did you start? You woke up one morning and decided I want to write this. How did the project start?
Exactly. It's great to ask this question because my personal story of being involved in ReactOS was I saw how Linux emerged from Unix and I had an idea. Why don't such a project exist for Windows? Why don't people make a free Windows clone? And I was browsing the internet, there was no Google back then in 2000 year. Uh-huh. And I browsed and I found some like five different projects which were quite small. And one of them was called ReactOS. It was quite advanced back then. It was able to boot into text mode console. It didn't support any Windows applications back then. But then over time we built it module by module and now it is able to load such complex applications like Microsoft Office, and we support some Visual drivers natively, so it's really intriguing for me. It was like a totally new experience.
Are you sharing any of the code with projects like Wine or those projects?
Absolutely. It's so great that these projects exist because Wine is essential for us. It's like at least half of our user mode code. However, we don't share that much code in kernel mode, unfortunately, because Linux is totally different architecture and BSD also totally different architecture. But other projects also use our code base. For example, this is Indies, Rapier, and some other projects. Also, there is, for example, FreeType library, which is a great library, and we use this for it saves us like many hours of coding time. So It's great that so many free open source projects exist. We wouldn't be able to build ReactOS without all those.
And are there any people running ReactOS in their businesses?
ReactOS is not ready yet for production. Okay. It's an alpha stage. However, we occasionally see different photos from throughout the world. Like we see something like Chinese supermarket where cash desks were running ReactOS. I did not believe myself in this photo, but it's kind of real. So, and we had similar experience from other parts of the world, mostly of some other countries. I did not see it myself, but people run it somewhere, and I'm really surprised.
And will the Windows viruses and all that stuff run on ReactOS as well?
Absolutely, this is our point.
You want the viruses running?
Yeah. Good. Some viruses are compatible. We can stamp on them that they react as compatible. But really many viruses based on some very, very Windows-specific stuff, like addressing directly by direct memory addresses and things like that. Fortunately, this breaks them on ReactOS. But still, many viruses would be compatible, absolutely.
Okay. And you were saying that you were able to run Microsoft Office on it, any particular versions, or is it just the older versions?
2013, if I don't mistake, yeah. And 2007 also runs.
So could I run this in a virtual machine to run that one application that will only run on Windows?
Absolutely, this is a preferred way to test ReactOS. However, also we have live CDs,
yep,
which are accessible from the desk. Yeah. They you can use them to boot your laptop, and it would not damage your hard disk in any way because it's an experimental project.
That's absolutely fantastic. I have an old application that I needed to run, and when I booted the virtual machine for XP, it wanted to register. And it wouldn't run anymore, so
yeah.
So this is an ideal solution. Okay, are you going to be giving any talks here at the show, or are you just going to be on the booth the whole time?
No, this year we're not giving talks. I gave a big talk about 7 years ago at FOSDEM. It was pretty much nice, but this way we decided to do only the stand here. So it's pretty crowded, and it's so nice to see so many people here.
Yes,
it's great.
Very big, yeah. Thank you very much for taking the time for the interview, and thanks very much for doing this. It might allow me to run some software very safely.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi everybody, my name is Ken Fallon. We're here at the AW building of FOSDEM 2015. I'm at the Core OS table, is that correct? And I'm talking to
Kelsey Hightower. I'm an engineer and evangelist at CoreOS.
And I'm Jonathan Bull. I'm software engineer at CoreOS.
What is CoreOS?
To me, the way I describe it quickly, it's Google's infrastructure that you can download.
But it's not actually written by Google, is it?
Right. So it's written by CoreOS, and we've taken a lot of the patterns you see in large distributed computing systems, like you would typically find at Google, and one of our main flagship products is our operating system, which is a container-optimized Linux distribution.
Yep, so CoreOS is an automatically updating Linux distribution. So as soon as patches are available, we push them out and they update distributions automatically. The idea is to make it totally seamless so that systems administrators don't even need to think about it. Updates just happen.
Okay, and you're following the mainline kernel, which would be pretty strange.
Right, so we try to ship the latest and greatest stable kernel, so more like the tradition that you see in a rolling distro. So what we want to do is make sure that all the latest features like OverlayFS that just recently got merged into the kernel, IPv VLAN support that has got merged in the kernel, are available like weeks once they're available instead of like every 2 years. So that's our main goal there.
And how do you manage, how are you able to produce an operating system like that when you have companies like Red Hat and SUSE? So what's the difference between the two, I guess?
I think it's our contract with the end user. So CoreOS and its philosophy and the technology, the OS itself, since it's a read-only root file system, the contract between us and your application, meaning we don't ship Ruby, Python, the JVM, we can actually update our OS in an atomic fashion since we expect all your applications to be running in a container. So we have a little bit more wiggle room and freedom to change the underlying operating system because the kernel is so stable that applications shouldn't be doing anything outside of like system calls.
Right, so the operating system itself is very minimal. It's essentially just the kernel, systemd, the init system, and an SSH server, and then something like Docker to be able to run application containers. So we don't provide any of the standard sort of, you know, JVM or Python or anything like that. So we don't have to worry about maintaining those and maintaining application compatibility. So it's a much smaller operating system. We use vanilla upstream components wherever possible.
Okay, and are you a company or how are you organized?
Yeah, so we're a startup based out of San Francisco, California. We're post Series A, so we're in the stage now where we have a business model and we're selling services and software. We're a software company first, so our main products are CoreOS. We sell commercial support on that, consulting services, and accessories around that, distributed computing like Docker registries. We have our own runtime container, Rocket, things like that.
And are you working on an open core model, or are those open as well?
Everything is open source, so all of our technology is open source. The only things that are not open source are things like our Docker registry or some of our GUI applications that sit on top. But all of the core technology, etcd, the operating system, there's no freemium model. It's all open source, and then we just add value on top.
Guys, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
A lot.
We're at Saya SSL, is that right?
We pronounce it C-Yazzle. C-Yazzle.
Okay, can you spell that? That's Charlie Yankee Alpha Sierra Sierra Lima.
Correct.
And that's a SSL library.
Yeah, so we're a lightweight, portable SSL library.
Okay. That's been very much in the news of late, SSL libraries.
SSL in general has.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what makes you different from OpenSSL or LibreSSL?
Yeah, so we focused on a couple of things.
Yeah.
So we've written C-Yazzle from the ground up, from scratch, in 2006.
Okay.
And we focused on the embedded market, mainly. So we focused on portability, size.
Yeah.
So we're 20 times smaller than OpenSSL in a typical build, with a footprint size of around 60 to 100 kilobytes.
Yeah.
Okay. So that really pays off on, you know, a small resource-constrained device.
Yeah.
Now,
do you lose a lot of the functionality then as a result of that?
No, that's a full TLS 1. Up to TLS 1.2 client and server.
Okay. And server.
Yep.
Okay.
And we're very portable. We support about 20 operating systems out of the box.
Yeah.
So, you know, people don't have to spend time porting to a new platform.
Okay.
Most likely we'll support it. And then we support a handful, you know, 5 to 6 embedded hardware crypto engines.
Yeah.
So we can take advantage of hardware cryptography on the device.
Okay, very good. And what sort of licenses is it released under?
This is, C-Yazzle is a dual license product.
Okay.
So it's dual license under the GPL version 2 and a commercial license.
Okay. And why would I pick one over the other?
GPL 2 version 2 either makes sense for an open source project, they can tolerate that, or for someone who's prototyping.
Yeah.
So it allows someone to download it off our website and start playing with it right away.
Yeah.
Now the commercial license is for a commercial application who doesn't want to abide by the terms of the GPL version 2.
Yeah.
So being that it's the same code base, the license headers just change. It makes it for a seamless move from GPL to commercial.
Okay. But then if I was contributing to the project, I would need to sign some sort of agreement over to you, would I?
Right. We have people fill out a contributor agreement
when
they want to contribute back to C-Yazzle.
And they give up the rights to the GPL for the closed version, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say they give up their rights. They're
allowing you. They're giving you also the right to cross-license it.
Right. They're contributing back. They're giving us ownership of their changes.
Yeah, okay. Right. Very good. And are there many people running with this application?
We have several hundred customers around the world, and that's growing.
Yeah.
We've doubled within the last year.
Yeah.
Both revenue and close to employees.
Okay, very good. And do you, how do I know that the code is secure? With the, are there going to be audits done? Or, how do I get that warm, fuzzy feeling?
Yeah, sure. So we've been around nearly 10 years.
Yeah.
We've had, you know, hundreds of commercial customers look at us. We've had lots of open source people look at us. We work all the time with universities and academics who are, you know, testing new, they're looking for vulnerabilities. They're testing SSL libraries and crypto libraries to see if they're exactly that, if they're robust and secure.
So the GPL version is exactly the same as the commercial version, so that somebody can research it, can download the code, hacking it as much as they want, and then report back the bugs to you, or
exact same code base. We were born out of MySQL, kind of.
Yeah.
They wanted a clean room SSL library.
Okay.
And they have the same license model, dual license, GPL commercial.
Very good.
So we followed their license.
So is there anything new coming up this year that you want to tell people about?
We're hiring more and more developers, so we can be more and more progressive.
Yeah.
So we're pretty excited about being one of the first ones to hopefully implement TLS 1.3.
Yeah.
We're going to have some new crypto stuff coming up. So Curve 255.19, ED 255.19. And we also have added support for the ChaCha 20 and Poly 1305 algorithms. So those are two new ones that Apple is pushing big with the HomeKit. So we expect them to be popular in IoT and smart home applications.
Okay, yeah. So, and I guess there's a lot of push now with the Internet of Things to have SSL devices everywhere.
There is. It's almost a necessity these days.
Yeah, it kind of is.
If a device communicates, you're probably going to be in trouble if it's not secure.
Yeah, sooner or later you're going to get the call doc. Are you giving talks at all, or are you just going to be focused here for the...
This year we're just focused on the stand.
Yeah, and if people want more information, they can get it at your website. So what's the difference between Wolf SSL and the name, which I can't pronounce?
Yeah, so let me clarify that. Wolf SSL is our company name.
Yeah.
And our product name is CYAZL.
CYAZL. Wolf and SSL is a lot easier to remember.
One thing to keep in mind, probably within the next month, we're going to be changing and rebranding CYAZL as Wolf SSL.
Yeah, probably
so
no harm.
It should be much more consistent.
Yeah, and you get a nice cool logo as well.
Right.
Well, okay. Thank you very much for taking the time, and enjoy the rest of the show.
You're welcome.
And I'm talking to Pico TCP, and your name is?
Martin.
Martin. What is Pico TCP?
Pico TCP is the embedded TCP IP stack for your reference, because it's beyond the foremost, the smallest and most modular Pico TCP stack on the market. You can unplug each module. If you want to have a very small stack, you can also say, I want an IP layer and a TCP protocol on that, and that's everything I need. So you just configure it to build this, and you can get started with a few kilobytes of, few tens of kilobytes of flash and RAM memory.
Oh, very good. So really focused on the embedded market, I guess.
Yeah, indeed.
And are you a project or a company?
We are a company. And the project started from one of our developers who, in his free time, who said, well, I want to make the best TCP IP stack in the world. And he went started. And then at some point he said, maybe we can do this as an internal project. And that's the point where Pico TCP was born.
And what sort of licenses is it available under?
We have some dual licensing here. We support a GPL v2 license, and we have also a commercial license for companies who want to use it and sell products with Pico TCP.
So if I was contributing my changes back, I'd need to sign a contributor agreement with you guys.
Yeah, I need. Yeah.
So do you maintain the same code base, or is it always, is everything the same?
We have one code base, it's on GitHub, it's free for everyone to clone.
Okay. And you find that businesses are, have you shipped it in many products?
Sorry?
Have many devices been shipped using Pico TCP?
Not ready, but because we are pretty young. Yep. But we have already some customers and some people who are interested to use Pico TCP on a large scale of embedded devices.
Okay, and do you support IPv6?
Yeah, we do. We do actually both. You can make a hybrid stack if you want.
Okay, and do you support things like IPsec and that sort of thing?
IPsec we don't support at this point, but we are always open to implement new protocols.
Okay, and so say I was a company and I wanted, desperately had loads of money and I wanted that, for instance, I could contract you to do that under the GPL if I wanted.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, I'd love to. So what language is it written in?
It's written in C, it's plain C.
Yeah. And is there anything else? You keep your code on GitHub, it's under GPL v3. Yeah, yeah. Are you going to be given any talks here?
Yeah, of course. We have two talks. One is about mesh networking, where we promote Pico TCP as a protocol where we can use OLSR to make large mesh networks with small devices.
Have you actually done that in practice?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
And it works okay?
Yeah, it works. Yeah. And for more figures, of course, you should join the presentation because there our mesh networking specialists will be there. So.
Oh, fantastic. If I forget to put the link into the show notes, it will be available on the FOSDEM website for people who are listening to the show. Anything else coming up in this year that you want to tell us about?
We are every time implementing new protocols.
Yep.
Next to this, we are also very, we think it's very important to have a good code quality. So we are constantly monitoring our code quality through Jenkins, a continuous integration system.
Yep.
We have static code analysis through Tix. That's a big tool that checks things like code coverage, compiler warnings, static code analysis, things like memory leaks and other stuff at plain sight of the code.
Yeah.
And we also have a lot of tests that run on targets, on embedded targets, to test if the RFC compliance is good, if everything works as it should be. And all those things are run every night. So we have a nightly build, but we have also nightly tests. And every time we commit, we have a lot of tests that are scheduled at that point.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much for your time and enjoy the rest of the show.
Okay, thank you.
We've come over to the Ultimaker.
Ultimaker.
And your name is?
My name is Oliver.
And what are you doing here?
What are we doing here? We're showing off our amazing 3D printers, which are fully open source, and that's why we're at FOSDEM.
And are you a company that makes these devices?
Yes. Ultimaker is the number one in quality, especially a 3D printer manufacturer. We're from the Netherlands. We make a Dutch product. And as I said, we're fully open source.
Ah, very good. And how do you make your money on this if this is fully open source?
We sell the printers, the physical printers. That's where we make our money.
Okay.
We have software that's used to take the 3D model and turn it into something the printer understands, which is for free. You can download it. Everybody can get it. We have firmware on there that's community developed. It's Marlin. It's from other 3D printers use it well. So there's no money there. The design of the printer is open source as well, so everybody can build it, but we build it, assemble it, and ship it, and that's where our income is from.
Could I buy it as a case and put it together myself?
Yes, obviously our listeners cannot see it, but over here we have our Ultimaker Original, which is a wooden version of our printer.
Yep.
It's the first one that got into production. It was targeted towards makers and hackers. That was the idea of the printer, which is it's sold as a kit, and it's fully self-assemblable. It takes about 8 to 10 hours, though, to assemble. It's a lot of screws and lots of bits and pieces, but it's certainly doable. And the two printers that we have in front of us are the more consumer-oriented versions.
Yep.
You could assemble it if you would be able to get the materials. That's the tricky part here. That's why we sell it as a unit.
And what sort of plastic do you... Describe it to me, what this thing does.
What this thing does is, if you ever seen a hot glue gun,
yep,
that you fix things with,
It's a very expensive hot glue gun, is what you say.
It's a very expensive hot glue gun. If you backtrack it in a sense, somebody brought out a 3D printing pen, which really is just a hot glue gun. And it's based on the same principle. This one just does all the movement for you. You don't have to put down layer for layer for layer that you would do with your hot glue gun. The machine does it for you.
And this is a single color printer.
This is a single color printer. You can change the filament during the print. There's options for it in the software, and stop at this height, and so I can change the filament. There's options for that, but it doesn't do anything like that by itself.
So when we say it's a printer, you've got an X axis, Y axis, and the place itself is heated. The place itself is heated, and the place goes up and down on the bottom.
Yes, exactly. This bigger unit has a heated plate. The small one, the really small one that we have now, does not have a heated bed. It's to make it a little bit more affordable.
And what's the advantage of having a heated plate, by the way?
Adhesion, plastic adhesion. The plastic that we print best adheses either to blue masking tape that a lot of painters use, and a warm surface. Because, yeah, it's a pure adhesion issue.
So if you've got blue masking tape, you don't need a adhesive.
I think the prints without tape turn out nicer. You can have a mirror smooth finish,
yeah.
Because the plastic flows out a little bit onto the glass. And the masking tape will always leave the ribbles from the tape itself.
Okay.
Sometimes the tape will stick to your object that you're printing. You have to replace the tape every once in a while because it tears. And if you don't put it on perfectly, you will also see that in your result. It is, as I said, more affordable, more easier to use.
Are you making a profit?
I'm sorry?
Are you making a profit? Are you
on the printers, yes.
And
we're a healthy company at this moment.
That's excellent news. Can I come work for you? No. So what is the maximum size that you can build with one of these printers?
The build volume of this one is a very roughly estimate, because I don't know it by heart, but it's about 20 by 20 by 20.
So give me an idea.
Size
of a skull.
Well, look at the object here. I think this robot I have in my hand right now, which is, what is it, about almost 20 centimeters in height.
About
is
6 inches, I guess.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and we have an international audience, so we need to.
Yeah, that's about the height you can print with this one. Volume-wise, you can go a little bit wider, obviously, but also 20 centimeters, so about 6 inches, 6-7 inches in length. Really.
Okay, I'm bracing myself now for the next question. How much does it cost?
That's a very difficult question.
What price can you put on low?
If you let, I always tell people, I'll tell you the price in a minute, but I always tell people, you only buy one printer, and after that, all the Christmas and birthday presents are free.
There you go.
For, yeah. You're settled for life. Yeah. No, the kit version is €1,000 without taxes.
Oh my God. Yeah.
It's not that bad, actually.
If
you look
go
at
back
the components,
in, yeah.
Components are not that cheap that are in it. The small one here, which comes pre-assembled, is €1,500.
Yeah.
This one comes in at €2,000.
Yeah.
And the bigger one that we announced together with a really small one last CES is about 15 centimeters higher.
Okay, and you can basically build
more. It's the same size, just 30 centimeters higher.
I know a lot of people are having a heart attack now listening to this at home.
I know,
but
it's
then
difficult.
On the other hand, it's, you know, 3D, you look at laser printers from, you know, I can remember 5-10 years ago, laser printers were thousands of dollars.
Yes, absolutely.
And for, as a mechanical engineer, we did a lot of prototyping. And you would spend that just to get the plastic components.
Well, yeah,
and it goes wrong, and you have to wait another 6 weeks to get them redone again. So it's
that's sort of one of the markets that we're well, not aiming for, but it's a very interesting market, is companies, businesses, architects, they just buy these because for them, €2,500 is not a lot of money.
It's
nothing.
Yeah.
A 40,000, 50,000 machine from one of the big players, that's a different category. So now you have a relatively cheap printer. You can build your model in a few hours, maybe over the weekend, and you have your thing. Even if your company has a big machine that costs a lot, they only have probably one, maybe two if you're really lucky.
And it's owned by Bob and the
others. You have to queue for it, and you know, it's all a lot of red tape. This you can just give one to each office or each employee even if you want to.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really accessible that way.
Why does that one seem a lot faster than this one?
This one is still printing the bottom layer right now,
okay.
And the bottom layer is more sensitive than the rest. So we print that a little bit slower, so it comes out nicer. So it's nice and smooth, so it adheres nicely. And once you're done with the bottom layer, you can ramp up the speed.
Okay. Where are you based in the Netherlands?
Just below Utrecht, in Geldermalsen.
Geldermalsen. Excellent. I've run out of questions. What's the news? The news is the small printer, the bigger printer.
The small printer and the big printer, we just announced at CES, and we hope to start shipping them April.
And everything's open source, everything's free?
Everything's open source. We're software developers, so this is not a sales and marketing event to us.
Yeah.
I explicitly told our company, our bosses, that we want to go here because this is from developers for developers.
Yes.
It's much different than at CES. At CES, we don't go there.
So you came to be a developer. Do you know the free software? So
to answer your earlier question, the software that we use to convert a 3D model to something a printer understands.
Yeah.
It's fully open source.
Yeah.
The software, the firmware that drives the printer is fully open source. The electronics design is, although it is LTM files, the files themselves are open source, the GPL. The mechanical designs are open source. The license at the moment is Creative Commons by share alike with a non-commercial closure added, which I'm personally hoping to push my bosses to maybe drop that, which is my personal opinion, of course. It's not what the company wants, or maybe they do, I don't know yet. But that in that case, we can drop the non-commercial bit, then we become open hardware, and I think we even could become a Free Software Foundation approved.
Yeah, which would be pretty impressive. Can I steal some of the little robots?
You can have as many as you want.
I need three, and of different colors specifically.
Or, you can have six if you
thank
want
you very much.
It cost me 2 months to print them.
Because,
yeah, well, they're all printed on our own printers.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. Thank you very much for taking the time, and I hope to bump into you in the Netherlands sometime soon.
You're welcome.
We're talking to?
Carl Daniel Heilfinger.
Okay, and Carl, you're representing two projects here. What are they?
The first is the Coreboot project, and the second is the Flashroom project. Coreboot is a replacement for your BIOS and EFI. It actually does that not only quite well, but it really excels at that. You might have used the device running Coreboot, you might just have not noticed. For example, the Chromebooks from Google, those laptops are pretty much all running Coreboot. Now, on the other hand, Flashrom is a tool which is also not that well known. It's very useful if you, for example, plan to reflash or update your BIOS, change the firmware of the PXE ROM on your network card, want to change the firmware of your monitor, or maybe update the firmware of your DVD drive. All that stuff is something which you can do from user space, from Linux, from BSD, or other operating systems, even MS-DOS, with the help of Flashrom.
So these are the annoying little programs that you download from Dell and you must be running a version of Windows in place of that.
Yes, not only that, rebooting just to make a BIOS update or a firmware update, it's silly, isn't it? It's something which, let's just say, rebooting into a specially designated Windows DVD to update your BIOS is probably not something which you would associate with reliability. So Flashrom tends to do away with all that, and it does so nicely. Well, on the other hand, Coreboot is something which is okay. Admittedly, I'm a fan of Coreboot, otherwise I wouldn't be here at FOSDEM doing a booth for Coreboot and Flashrom. Coreboot is something which also has real benefits for you. It's booting faster than EFI and BIOS, quite noticeably so. We get down to half a second from power on to bootloader in a few configurations. Usually it's below 1.5 seconds, which is faster than BIOS and EFI if you think of it. The other benefit of Coreboot is that you can actually have the source code of the stuff which is running in your firmware, and that's quite nice from a freedom point of view, but I also know that many people do not really care that much about it as long as they know the stuff is secure. And if you have the source code, you at least have the theoretical ability of to inspect it. Well, I know most people don't read the source code of the stuff they are using, but still they would have the chance to do so. And then there's also the point that Coreboot is a bit easier to debug than a BIOS. For example, think of the last time you tried to find out why a machine didn't boot.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it as, did you hear those beep, 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 beep codes from your BIOS?
Mm-hmm.
The information you get from that is exactly mostly useless.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can plug in some post code diagnostics card, which gives you a 2-digit postcode, which tells you that in this special BIOS version there might be something wrong. With Core Boot, you get full debug on a serial port or a USB port, which tells you like the message on Linux kernel in detail what went wrong or what didn't go wrong. So you also have great diagnostics, have the freedom aspect, and also have the security aspect. And Core Boot does not ship with backdoors compared to pretty much every other BIOS or EFI based laptop you can buy out there.
Right. Them's are suing words, I would imagine.
Let's just say that nowadays it's hardly impossible, well, except for maybe the Chromebooks, to buy a laptop without those backdoors. Now let's talk backdoors. Let's talk clear text. Let's talk about why I call them backdoors. I should call them rootkits, which would be more accurate, but that's even more fighting words. So the point is, nowadays you get a feature which is called anti-theft solution.
Okay.
Which means, in the most common implementation, your BIOS accesses your hard, or your EFI accesses your hard drive, checks whether the Linux, OS X, or Windows running there has the persistent rootkit part of this anti-theft module installed. And if not, your Linux, Windows, or whatever will be infected with a nice rootkit, which can talk home just in case somebody steals your laptop and boots it and is stupid enough to do that with the network attached. Of course, that's also not exactly optimal if you want to be in full control of your laptop and you don't care about theft protection. Then you rather not have a rootkit in your machine, especially a persistent rootkit, which won't even be removed after exchanging the hard disk, because the BIOS or EFI will always reinstall it again.
So this is like a feature of BIOS, of EFI?
It's not really a feature, but it's an add-on module to EFI and BIOS, which is nowadays shipped by pretty much every vendor for, well, it's a feature, it's theft protection. Everybody wants it, don't you?
Okay. And when you say it calls back, who's it calling back to?
Usually servers either from the company selling that add-on module, or the service of your laptop vendor. And to be honest, if your laptop is not stolen, this thing is active, anybody is sitting at that vendor, whether it be some employee goofing off or somebody from a criminal organization who doesn't like you, can get control of your laptop. And this has in the past been implemented very badly. It has also been demonstrated in the past that you can exploit quite a few of those theft protection systems and get remote control, even if you're not from the vendor, not authorized.
Okay, that's great news here for everybody to hear. And Core Boot, how do I go about getting that?
Well, now there's a catch. Everything which is great usually has a catch. With Core Boot, the biggest... let's call it a problem. Issue is not the right word. The biggest problem is that quite a few vendors are not interested in Core Boot, are not interested in cooperating. Core Boot is not just like some operating system which you can just install. Core Boot needs to know stuff about the hardware, stuff you can't even discover on current hardware. So sometimes you need to break out a logic probe and find out some of the wiring. It's gotten better in the last few years. For example, the PCI slots died, which killed quite a few interrupt routing problems we had. we had to figure out each time. So essentially, Core Boot needs to support your processor. It needs to support your chipset. Now, if that both points are a given, then you can start porting Core Boot to your laptop, desktop, server, or whatever. And then it's a matter of picking the right pieces together, piecing them together, firing it all up, and hoping it works. It usually doesn't work on the first try. And for example, laptops usually also have to have some funny interactions with backlight control and stuff like that. So you have to reverse engineer quite a lot of stuff if your laptop or desktop or whatever is not yet supported. However, if you follow the rainbow and start to dig for a pot of gold and your machine is actually on the list of supported boards by Coreboot, it's pretty easy. It's usually on laptops, just opening them up, attaching an external programmer to the flash chip on the main board and writing a working Coreboot image on that. And if you ask nicely, we'll give you a reference image. Otherwise, it's fully supported to compile those images on your own and select your own configuration options. And then if you pick the right image, you reboot and you have a machine with Coreboot and it's running nicely.
And fast.
That
boots goes fast, at least.
It boots fast, and I think there might be some enthusiasts out there who do high-end audio processing. For example, if you're doing a podcast, you want to do some live audio source mixing, something like that. Maybe you might have noticed that sometimes you get X runs with ELSA or something like that, or noticeable latency. It's exactly the thing you don't want if you do something like audio processing, industrial control or similar. With Coreboot, one of the additional big benefits is that you can avoid running code in the background. Most EFI and BIOS tend to keep stuff running in the background for various management tasks. Unless absolutely necessary, Coreboot does not do that. There's no background task running. Great from a latency perspective. It's also great from a security perspective, because if you, for example, are working in, let's just say, highly secure facilities, or for example, if you're doing government, military work, stuff like that, you want to be very sure of what is running on your machine.
Yeah.
First of all, you want to be trusting the firmware, and second of all, after the firmware is gone and somebody has evaluated your operating system, you do not want any code running in the background messing with your operating system. So Coreboot does away with all that unless absolutely necessary, and even then it's doing only the minimal amount of work. So for a latency perspective and also from a security, holistic security point of view, it's also a great thing to run Coreboot.
Okay, how did you get into doing Coreboot in the first place?
It's a long story. Back when the OLPC initiative, the One Laptop Per Child initiative, brought out their first prototype, they had some commercial BIOS running on them with the explicit stated goal of replacing that with Coreboot. And I was very interested in that, had been following Coreboot passively for 1 or 2 years, and it was one of my chances, it was the chance for me to get my feet dirty or my feet in the water. And I started helping with the effort of getting Coreboot to run on the OLPC X01. Admittedly, nowadays the XO laptops do not run Coreboot. They do run open firmware, which is also open source and was a bit more suited to what they were doing. Still, Coreboot is a really great choice, especially because it supports such an amount of diverse chipsets, processors, and also hardware. We have hundreds of laptops or boards, hundreds of different main boards supported.
Okay, and do you have a list of these on the website so that I don't need to reinvent the wheel?
We do have a wiki, which is actually pretty current. We also have board status bot, which tests whether the current code still compiles for your favorite board. Some vendors like Google are doing integration testing and checking whether the Coreboot branch they are developing still works on the devices they are shipping. And they are shipping also means, all Chromebooks. So there is quite some testing going on, and yes, the website is saying a lot, but I also have to admit that our website is not always current in all aspects. So even if you don't find something listed on our website, download our source code. How to do that is listed on our website, on the Coreboot website. And dig around the source tree. You might find your chipset or your CPU listed, even if it's not mentioned in the wiki.
So what's the worst that can happen when...
The worst that can happen when you ask the Coreboot mailing list whether your hardware is supported is, can you please go and read the wiki? Let's talk more about what's the worst that can happen if you try to get Coreboot running on your board.
Yeah.
The worst case that can happen is that your machine is a brick temporarily. So if flashing you flashed a Coreboot image which does not work for your machine, the machine will not boot or only boot partially. Then you have to attach an external programmer to the flash hub of your laptop or board and reflash a hopefully better working image or a backup of the previous BIOS or EFI. So it's not really dead, but you may have to open the machine and attach a clip to the flash chip, which is not that hard. Soldering is usually not involved unless somebody put epoxy all over your main board and you can't access the flash chip. In that case, you might have to scrap away some epoxy. But if you're not afraid of opening your machine, then nothing really can happen. You shouldn't maybe try to reflash Coreboot while you're traveling and have no external backup doing that. Well, some of us did that and it worked out, but it's not something I would recommend to somebody
for the first time.
But still, it's a lot of fun to be had with. And yeah, the reflashing is something you would do with FlashROM.
Okay.
So, and that's where FlashROM enters the picture again. And FlashROM can abuse pretty much any device to flash pretty much any chip. We have had people who abused an Intel network card, desold the flash chip from that one, put some wires on there instead, and connected those wires to the flash chip of a second main board, and then used the network card together with FlashROM to reflash the BIOS of the other main board. It does work. It's weird. People will look at you like you're crazy, but actually FlashROM is meant to do that.
Okay. This is so far out of my sphere of knowledge. I'm just going to find out whatever laptop you're using and make sure I buy the exact same one.
Yeah, well, that's a very well supported model is the ThinkPad T60. It's pretty old, but it's sturdy, it's reliable, it's time tested. Nowadays, we also support many more modern laptops of the T series and of the X series.
All IBMs.
Well, yeah, Lenovo nowadays.
Yeah, Lenovo, yeah.
There are also a few HP laptops supported, and I think an AMD-based ThinkPad is also supported, and then, of course, all those Chromebooks, and then there are also various desktop and server main boards. But usually the wiki is pretty well up to date regarding laptops. So if you see a laptop listed there, there's a good chance it will work out of the box.
Okay, fantastic. So anything else that's going to happen this year that you want us to know about?
An appeal to all the listeners out there. Apparently, some hardware vendors are still not aware of what Coreboot is.
Yeah.
Especially the firmware departments. And the key to a hardware vendor is actually the salespeople, at least in my experience. So, if you talk to your company, you talk to some hardware vendor and tell them, yeah, we would like to buy some hardware, tell them that you might want to have core boot on those laptops or on those servers? On the servers, it's easy to justify, just you don't want 7 minutes of boot time. You want something like 20 seconds or 2 seconds of boot time. And if enough salespeople hear the word core boot, they might start to inquire with their management, what is this core boot stuff? And that might get us the awareness to actually have vendors listen to us and take us not as a competition, but actually as people who want to help them make their products better. That would be really, really great. And other than that, go out, find some nice hardware which is supported by core boot or which has CPU and chipset supported by core boot if you want to tinker and work with that. We'll try to help you and it will be great fun for everyone involved.
Okay, with that, I'm going to end the interview. Thank you very much for taking the time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And we're standing outside in the middle of a field, right beside somebody who's got what looks like a Yagi antenna.
Well, actually, two of them.
Oh. Tell us more. What is it and why are you here? Who are you for a start?
So, my name is Pieris Papadeas, and I'm a member of the SatNogs team from Athens, Greece.
SatNogs, N-O-G-S?
That's S-A-T-N-O-G-S.
Okay. Sierra Alpha Tango November Oscar Golf Sierra.
That's pretty good. Are you an amateur operator too? Most of us are. So what SatNogs is basically a ground station for tracking satellites. Okay. So you can see the antennas, and in the middle there is the tracking box, and it has a gear assembly inside.
Yeah.
And you can track satellites as they cross across the sky, and you can receive signals, demodulate them, record them, and then upload them back to the network.
You can you?
Oh, yeah.
Very interesting. And you've got X and Y axis on this?
Yes, so we call them the azimuth and the altitude.
Yeah.
But yes, that's pretty much it. So you have 360 degrees on the azimuth and 0 to 90 degrees on the altitude.
So you're going to be, if you're tracking, you'll be tracking the parabola.
The half sphere, the hemisphere basically around you.
Okay, and what sort of interesting things are you doing for this?
So we have thousands of satellites out there, and we are now in this setup, which is a typical setup. You can see a VHF antenna and a UHF antenna, and we're focusing on satellites that use those antennas because we can receive the signals, right? And most of them are CubeSats. Lately, we have been having hundreds of CubeSats land.
What's a CubeSat?
A CubeSat is a really small satellite, 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters cube, 1 kilogram weight. It's used for small experiments by universities or projects or companies that want to deploy something really cheap and really quickly as a satellite. And the transmission frequencies that most of those CubeSats are using are VHF and UHF on those bands that we have the antennas. So we're helping tracking those satellites. So imagine if you're at a university and you have a CubeSat that you deployed, because you can only see it, you know, like 3 or 4 times per day on your location.
Yeah,
you can use the distributed network of ground
stations. I see where you're going.
Yes, and get a global coverage and create a network for that.
What happens here? The signals come in. Do you volunteer for a particular satellite or?
So it depends on the deployment. Right now, this is a tethered deployment, which means that we control the specifics of this deployment. So we choose which satellite and which transponder we're going to be following, and which frequency and blah, blah, blah. But generally, a permanent setup of a SatNogs ground station would be something on top of a rooftop connected to the network. So the network gets to say which ground station is going to do which operation, which scheduled operation. So if you are an operator, you have a satellite, or you are an amateur satellite observer, or you like satellites, you can go into the network, say, I want to follow this satellite with this frequency during this time frame, and the network automatically calculates all the sightings from different ground stations and sends those observation schedules to the ground stations. The ground stations execute them, record the messages, and bring them back to the network.
How fast are these satellites going past?
Oh, it depends on the orbit, but let's say a good pass would be something like 11 or 12 minutes. But okay. It really depends on the orbit, though.
So, for example, if you set one of these up, mm-hmm. it's likely that you know the whole day it'll be moving left, right, and
oh yeah,
and doing
oh, yeah.
other.
Oh yeah, we need as many ground stations as possible.
That's so, sure. talk me through this. This is a aluminium tripod. Have you built this yourself, or
yes.
have you purchased
everything? Everything that you see is designed and built from scratch, DIY, open hardware style. And the software too, open software obviously. And for the parts that are things that needed to connect between each other, we have all the plastic pieces basically that you see are 3D printed parts.
Yeah.
So we designed them on FreeCAD and then we printed it out on 3D printers, TAS 3 from Lalsbot in specific. And then all the tracking mechanism inside is also 3D printed, the gears, all the assembly.
Yeah.
And we're using also a commodity cheap electronics hardware for the reception side of things. So we're using an RTL SDR, okay. which is a DVB-T China, really cheap SDR dongle. An Arduino, two Pololu drivers for the stepper motors, and an LNA, the LNA for all, which is an upper hardware one.
I thought like they making an antennas kind of hard.
Not really. I mean, given the right expertise, fortunately, we do have in our team some RF experts, and they designed in NEC the theoretical model, and then we designed it. We printed the parts, we construct the antenna, and using a vector network analyzer, we were able to match the frequencies and check if the theoretical model still works in practice, which it did, yeah. And that's the good part of it.
So, can I buy this online, or do I make it?
So, you can visit satnox.org, yeah. Which is the website that has all the information about how to build one.
Yeah.
Right now, we don't supply any kits, although we plan to do that in the future.
Yeah.
And you can join the community and help us you know, grow the project more, host a ground station, or even build more yeah. around it.
Would you need to, because you're receiving only, I guess, you wouldn't
right
need
now,
to
yes.
be a ham radio. You wouldn't need any specific license to do
depends
that.
Depends on the legislation of your country.
Yes.
Yeah, some countries it's kind of like a gray area whether you can yeah. actually own something
oh, yeah,
that
yeah,
yeah something yeah, that yeah. that can
that
receive
can also
on,
transmit as well.
Right? Yeah, but it really depends on your area. And then for transmitting, of course, you have to be a
on how big your fence is.
Oh yeah. who gets to see what's happening?
Yeah, exactly. How much is that going to set me back?
So everything from the tripod to the embedded PC to the SDR to the antennas to the tracking box would be around 350 euros.
Oh, that's not bad, actually.
Yeah, it's actually 1/10 of the commercially available equivalent in terms of the specifications.
Yeah, and you get to find out very quickly if you have nice neighbors or not.
For sure.
So, cool. Anything else that's coming up on the project that people want to know about? Say you could build this. I know we have a lot of ham radio guys. That this would be no problem for them to build. They build it, and then what do they go to?
And then
to?
The next stage is to deploy a Satnox client, which connects us back to the network. So instead of using it only for your own observations, making it available for other people around the world to use it,
yep.
so contribute back to the network. That's the thing. And then generally for the project, the next steps are expanding the bands that we're using. Right now we're using only VHF and UHF, and now we're expanding also to S-band. That's 2.4 gigahertz using dishes.
Yeah.
So that requires some mechanical changes.
Yeah.
The R&D team is working on that heavily, and we would welcome some contributions around that, that's for sure.
I have my first show that I was supposed to, this is procrastination for you, I was going to do how to point a satellite dish as my show. I still haven't submitted it, and it's been 10 years now, so maybe it will,
well,
maybe
should,
it will
yeah,
come.
Once we have a dish all up and running.
Anything new that's going to be coming up this year or that I need to know about? Or
yeah, global deployment. We just won the Hackaday Prize,
yeah.
and that was a huge push for the project.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how I heard about you. Yeah.
And now, given the budget that we have, we can safely say that we can support and fund the construction and deployment of many ground stations around the world. So we plan to have at least 50 ground stations deployed and working around the world until the end of the year.
Yeah.
So we're focusing massively on that right now.
Are there particular regions that you're not particularly well covered in?
Well, pretty much everything right now. That's the third one that you see right here.
Okay, so guys, yeah.
It's just new for all of us. But right now the community is working on US, on Australia, we have Netherlands, we have Argentina, and there is also a Singapore guy. Okay. So we have to be focused on Russia, that's for sure, Africa, and check the Central America, and Pacific will be a big thing. So if anyone of you has any contacts on Pacific Island.
We have people all over the world, and I'm sure they'll be clamoring. Yeah. A nice Pacific Island.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
we
fair enough.
Station there.
I had something else there that I wanted to ask you, but it's completely gone out of my head. But you're giving a talk. So
yeah, tomorrow.
Tomorrow, so people will be able to go to the FOSDEM website and see more of this. What's the weight like, and would I need to be a bit concerned about things like lightning and stuff?
Not really. It depends on where you deploy it. Yeah. And that's like all different antennas. So you don't have to really be worried about that. Plus, the typical setup, that's the mobile setup, but the typical setup includes a radome. So imagine a radar dome.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a whole sphere around it. So we designed and built it ourselves too. And that's for the permanent setup, so that we can bring it here. So you don't have to be worried. If it's properly insulated and properly grounded, you don't have to be worried.
Okay. Fantastic stuff. Thank you very much for the interview, and good luck with the project.
Thank you.
And good luck with the talk tomorrow.
Thank you. From the dirt and the underneath, come to our side. You won't believe what you see. We got everything you need for your new station. Take it from me with no manipulation. Sign up, no boy, download, enjoy. It's easy to say, we'll come and never replay. All you need is a wealth to break away from the bag. You see the light.
Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.